So if you're not already comfortable, please make sure, or feel invited to make yourself comfortable. And hopefully you can also hear me. And if at any point that gets difficult, then let me know. And same goes for any words that I might say or terms that I might use. Just feel free to stop and ask for repetition or clarity. So I'd like to speak a little bit more about the practice that we're doing here, about meditation practice, about Dharma practice. And this word Dharma, which many people are familiar with, maybe some aren't, usually referred to, it's got many, many translations, many meanings. It's a word in Sanskrit and in Pali, in the old languages of India. Often used to refer to the body of the teachings of the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition. It also means the way things are. It means the way things are. And today, in the context of this talk, speaking about the practice, about Dharma practice, really speaking about it in a wide context. So both the kind of more specific form of meditation that we're exploring here when we're on the cushion, that aspect of the practice, but also the wider context of Dharma practice, of kind of really becoming familiar with, getting to know our experience, the way we operate, and the possibilities that we have there. And I'm going to use a little bit as the kind of core of this talk, some teachings that the Buddha actually gave to his son. It felt quite appropriate to have that father-son teachings in this context of having so many families here with us. Also, these are really profound and beautiful teachings, so it kind of ticks both boxes. Maybe I'll just take a little tangent and say that the Buddha wouldn't have been considered a model father in our day and age. Left his family when his son was just a baby to go off on his spiritual journey, and then they reunited when the Buddha was already enlightened and a teacher. He came back to his family, and many of them then became his devotees, including his son Rahula, who was I think a teenager at the time, like maybe about 16. Interesting, isn't it? Kind of context. And it's also very beautiful that within the teachings, and you know, from this kind of awakened master, there are a lot of teachings that are kind of personal teachings to his son. So I find that quite beautiful. And so they also feel very relevant, obviously, to practice in general and to what we're doing here specifically. So the first, I'm going to use a few pieces from these instructions that he gave, but the first one is the following. So the Buddha says to Rahula, "When you see that you've acted, spoken, or thought in a skillful way," and he explains what that means, what a skillful way means, "in a way that supports happiness, while not causing harm to yourself or others. Take joy in that fact and keep on practicing." So yeah, for me this is, yeah, just really profoundly beautiful teaching. When you see, when you notice that you've acted, you've thought, or you've spoken in a way that is skillful, in a way that leads to happiness, that creates happiness in you and does not cause harm either to yourself or to others, take time to enjoy that. Yeah? Really appreciate that. absorb that, take that in. And then continue practicing. Continue practicing in that way. And so really emphasizing the joy that's there when we act, speak, think skillfully in a way that leads to happiness and away from harm. And how that joy is a fuel for our further practice. So kind of in a way, another of the Buddha's saying, he said, the Dharma is sweet in the beginning, sweet in the middle, and sweet in the end. So kind of really bringing into our consciousness that possibility that practice is nourishing, is joyful, is beautiful, and that in itself is then a nourishment for more practice for us. And of course, by emphasizing that, we're not at all disregarding the fact that practice can also be difficult. Yeah, I mean, we've only been here a short time, and I'm sure whether you're an experienced meditator or a new meditator, you've already had moments when you've been sitting in the hall or doing walking meditation or just being here that have been, you know, unpleasant and not easy and sometimes really horrible. You know, so obviously opening to the joy, emphasizing the joy, doesn't mean that we ignore that also happens. Yeah, it's just another part that we bring in alongside the difficulty. And so these moments of joy can be a time to absorb, to reflect, to fuel our practice, to absorb. And the moments of difficulty or of challenge can be times when we need more perseverance, more commitment, more kind of staying with what's happening. But what the Buddha is pointing to, what the teachings are pointing to, is that capacity that we have to cultivate an attitude that can hold both. Yeah, to cultivate a capacity to be with both. That we have the possibility to approach challenge and difficulty with enthusiasm, with interest, if enthusiasm seems a bit of a tall order, a bit much to ask, but with interest. When I was just mentioning the word enthusiasm now, I was remembering a good friend of ours that we spent many years practicing together in India. And at some point in her practice, she got so enthusiastic about difficulties that she kind of used to say, "Bring them on," you know? She just got so enthusiastic about the dark side, about the difficulties, the challenges, because there was a sense of possibility, of the ability to open and work with, and the release that can come also from there. So that's kind of an extreme example, but it can happen, you know, we can have that actually. And what a shift, I mean, just in the smiles here, you know, around, I can see that we can feel that shift that's possible for us, instead of pushing away, withdrawing, closing down the enthusiasm, the interest, the opening also to the difficult. So we have that possibility, and it invites us to really be creative in our practice, to really be creative in our practice. And it energizes us, that enthusiasm, that interest, that inclusion energizes and actually awakens joy, actually brings joy and enjoyment, which maybe, yeah, I'm still seeing smiles, so I think like people are getting it, but can still feel like a bit of a contradiction maybe, but let's see if I can make it a bit clearer, or at least interesting enough that you explore it for yourself. So usually how human beings, and this was true 2,600 years ago when the Buddha was teaching, as well as today, the way we approach practice, the way we approach meditation on the cushion, the way we approach Dharma practice in the biggest context, is in two ways. There's two common ways that we do it. One is the kind of stay with it, you know, stick it out. Nathan and I call it Bharat Bhikkhu. I'll explain a little bit in a while why we call it that. But it's like the kind of like, and some traditions also really emphasize that, you know, just kind of stay, don't move, don't let the mind move, don't let the body move, just stick it out. And eventually it will pass. And hopefully something pleasant or more expansive will come. You know, so that's one common approach to meditation practice. The other common approach to meditation practice is that any kind of effort is counterproductive. And so what practice really is just about relaxing back, being with things as they are, being with things as they are, you know. And things will naturally unfold and change. And so these are kind of the two common attitudes to meditation practice, to Dharma practice. And there's a question. I have a question about the second. Oh, I didn't do the Bharat Bhikkhu story. Oops, sorry, rewind. The first attitude, sticking with it, staying with it, you know, just... So the story, which hopefully will be worth it, is that kind of in the early years of our practice, Nathan and I somehow got it into our heads that the Buddha used this phrase, Bharat Bhikkhu, many times. I don't know where it came from, this idea, but we got it into our heads. Bharat Bhikkhu. Bhikkhu means... anyone who practices, you know, traditionally it's monk or nun in Pali, but anyone who practices. And Bharat is just really just like, you know, just stiff upper lip, this British expression, you know, just stay with it, you know, don't move, don't try and change, don't. And so we had this idea that this was something that the Buddha said a lot. And so whenever one of us was kind of not liking something, didn't have to be on the meditation cushion, it was anything, you know, oh, you know, I don't like the way you make that meal, you know. Bharat Bhikkhu, we used to say to each other a lot. We really had this idea, this was a, you know, teaching from the Buddha. Many years later, we got our first Kindle, and we put the Buddha's discourses on the Kindle, you know, all the suttas. And someone told us, oh, the Kindle has this wonderful thing. You know, you can look, you can do a search on the Kindle for a phrase, and it will show you all the times it appears. So one of the first, I think the first thing we did was we put Bharat Bhikkhu into the Kindle. I don't think we came up with anything, you know? Maybe 2-3 times he'd actually said it. So it's, I'm saying that because of this idea, you know, we have an idea about practice, we have an idea, and we think, oh, that's what the Buddha said, for whatever reason. That's an attitude that we have, an approach. Equally, the second one, you know, oh, just relax, nothing to do. You know, just relax. No effort, effort gets in the way. Whereas in reality, neither one of these attitudes works if that's the only thing we do. You know, neither one of these works if that's the only thing we do. One teacher, Tanisara Bhikkhu, says if we follow any of these, either of these exclusively, just that, we're bound to get to a dead end. Because it's not enough. It doesn't actually resonate with our diversity of our being and our needs. So both these attitudes are helpful and useful some of the time. You know, sometimes we just have to stay with things. hopefully with a degree of also openness and relaxation and softness, not just harshness. And sometimes we just have to relax with things as they are. But when we see these as two complementary approaches, it actually allows us a much larger field of creativity. And we can play with them. We can see the whole range. What is needed? Or what is useful right now? And we actually gain a whole field of exploration which generates enthusiasm. Back to the enthusiasm I spoke of. So we're not just shutting down through just following one narrow thing, but we're opening to the diversity and the possibility. So what degrees of relaxation and effort are needed right now in this period in my practice, in this specific time, in this specific moment? We can start exploring that. Just like I was touching on with the physical posture today. You know, how much uprightness, steadiness, holding the body, bringing the body into an awake state is needed. And then how to marry that, how to combine that with relaxation, with receptivity. The same thing that happens in the body also happens in the mind. They reflect each other. And in the Buddha's own journey, you know, this was really, of course, these are all stories, they're teaching stories, but it was also a very, very powerful experience. His understanding of what he called this middle way, this marriage, you know, this place of bringing different attitudes together and finding where they meet, where they balance, which changes for us. So he went from living a life that was really all about gratification of sense desires and the pleasant to a life of extreme asceticism. You know, I think living on a grain of rice or something a day. And then one day he was so weak that he fainted. And as a result of that, he had some contemplation. And he remembered a time in his life, actually in his childhood, again, very relevant to our setting here, a time in his life, in his childhood, when he was sitting watching his father at work. He was sitting under a tree in the shade. And everything was as it should be. And he just very naturally fell into a state of deep meditation. And so that contemplation, that realization, brought him to this understanding of the middle way, of the need to bring together our deep commitment, with also a sense of ease, of relaxation, of what supports us to be open, receptive, at ease, the two together. And that the whole way the Buddha taught was this constant exploration of the middle way. One teacher from the Tibetan tradition, Elizabeth Matisse, she says that the Buddha's teachings of the middle way is about the power of an open question, that our practice is an open question. There isn't an absolute answer that's right all the time. It's about this process of creativity, of playfulness, of mixing things together. And so this kind of inclusive, creative attitude isn't easy. Yeah, and it takes a lot of commitment from us. It takes a lot of kind of presence, of bringing ourselves to the practice and to our lives. You know, I'm sure many of us have had these moments, maybe even now, where we just wish that somebody would just give us a recipe to enlightenment and let's be done with it, you know? Just tell me I can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, even up to 100, I'll do it, and that's it, you know? But that isn't possible. And it probably would also be a lot less fun if we kind of are honest. So really kind of taking on that commitment, that creativity, that playfulness that we can bring to practice and opening to that. And this kind of exploration, creative playfulness, experimentation, can get us in touch with happiness, with joy, both in the long term, but also right here and now. It opens up that possibility. And a happiness that is not conditioned so absolutely on sense desires, on pleasant things. So this, I'm going to kind of emphasize again, the key to staying inspired is to really bring this attitude of creativity and play to the practice as an opportunity to experiment, to ask questions, to let responses unfold, come up for us. And in his teachings to Rahula, the Buddha gave some kind of preliminary, we can say, practices that can help in setting the stage for this exploration. Some qualities or some attitudes that we can cultivate that can really support this field of then exploring, being creative, playful. And of course we also approach them with that. It's not like we only start the playfulness later. But they're kind of foundations. And he particularly emphasized patience and honesty. The patience and honesty. So this is what he said to Rahula. He said, meditate so that your mind is like the earth. Meditate so that your mind is like the earth. All kinds of things, this is a bit of a tricky image in our present day, but all kinds of things are thrown onto the earth, both beautiful things and harmful things. All things are thrown onto the earth, but the earth has no preference. It doesn't push some away and take some closer. It accepts whatever is thrown on it as it is. The words he used was beautiful and disgusting. I just saw in my quote. So that's pretty true in our days as well. And so similarly, we can ground ourselves in this quality, which is called patience in the tradition, where we are not overwhelmed by what we don't like, but by what is difficult. And we are also not kind of sucked in, not lost in what is pleasant. So we kind of make kind of really that image of earth, where like a big wide space where things can appear, things can be, things can arise without overwhelming, without us getting lost in them, whether they're pleasant or painful, beautiful or ugly. So a real groundedness, I've been using this word a lot, you know, really grounding ourselves, earthing ourselves in the kind of big scope of our being. You know, we can reflect sometimes over time, you know, all the things that have happened in our lives, all the moments we've known, all the events that have happened that have passed through us. You know, some of them have left some imprint, but they're not here anymore. So we have that capacity not to necessarily hold on, not to get lost in, not to get overwhelmed by. And the power of this quality of patience is, it's not about, you know, just doing this as the final goal, but we sit with something, we make space for something, until we have enough wisdom, enough clear seeing to know what the skillful response would be. And that can happen very quickly, and sometimes it can take a very long time. Sometimes it can take a very long time. But if we've ever had that experience of something coming up, can be something quite strong, and the ability to just stay steady with it, which takes both these approaches to practice that I spoke of. We need the ability to stay steady, to be with, to relax, to stay open, to see it, until the skillful response arises, until we know what is the skillful thing to do here. The second foundation that the Buddha instructed Rahula in was honesty. And so he said, look at the non-solid and impermanent nature of events in body and mind, so that you don't develop a sense of I am around them. This is a really tall order. Yeah. Look at the non-solid, impermanent nature of events in body and mind, so that you don't develop a sense of I am around them. So watching, looking, opening, seeing as much as we can, the not me, not mine of experience, events moving through, things arising, physical sensations, emotional feelings, memories, roles that we have arising. But seeing the impermanence of them, seeing the non-solid nature of them, so that that tendency that is so strong in us to make it who I am can loosen up a little bit, at least, can loosen up a little bit. And as a kind of more precise instruction with this, the Buddha also said to Rahula, a lot of teachings for a young guy, he also said to him, learn to look at your actions and your speech before, during, and after they happen. So notice the intention. Pay attention as it's happening, and then reflect when it's passed. If you see that the action or the speech is unskillful, so unskillful means it has caused harm, it is causing harm if it's in the present, or it will cause harm if it's in the future. That's unskillful. If you see that, then stop as soon as possible. Stop as soon as possible. And don't repeat. Stop as soon as possible and don't repeat. If it's possible, then go and talk to someone whom you trust about it. I love this bit. If it's possible, go and talk to someone who you trust about it afterwards. But what a teaching, so profound. And again, this is what we're doing here. This is the practice. And of course, we're all like not even babies at this, you know, we're still like maybe in the womb, maybe not even. So to see that in ourselves, you know, we don't need to have these expectations of, oh, I need to be able to do this, but this is a skill we're learning. To be able to see, to look at our actions, our thoughts, our speech, before they happen, at the level of intention, during the happening, and then also afterwards. And that last one we can all do. Yeah. We can reflect back. Can reflect back. And so this is a teaching in honesty. It's a teaching in clear seeing. Actually seeing what is happening, what is arising, what is playing through me. Letting go of, I like it, I don't like it, I need to have it, I shouldn't have it. But just honesty, this is what's happening right now. I use this example a lot, but quite a few years ago, through practice, I discovered I was lazy. And, you know, I really didn't like it. I still don't. You know, me, lazy? I do so much. I work so much. I discovered I was lazy. That was the truth. Honesty. And so acknowledging it, being honest about it, allows me to see it much more when it arises. And sometimes it's not a bad thing. And sometimes something else is needed. But it gives us that possibility, that honest seeing gives us possibility. Because we're not busy hiding or acting from an idea rather than the reality of what is. And what really helps with this practice, what really helps is to remember that we're all a work in progress. So this is experimentation. Whatever I see in myself is not kind of a solid box of who I am. It's an aspect. It's a manifestation. It's something that's arising right now. And if I see my actions, my thoughts, my speech, my personality traits, my habits, if I see them as experiments, that means that I can also, there's also the possibility of change. They're not eternal, they're not permanent. Something that arises. And so if I see that something is harmful or unhelpful, I can cultivate the intention to let that go. I can cultivate the intention to stop when it gets going. And these are all things that really can be done. Yeah, we're babies, but you know, we see babies here, we see how much they're learning and doing moment by moment, you know, it's pretty fast. This is something we can learn. This is something we can adapt to in our lives. If we remember that we're doing our best and that we can let go of that which isn't wholesome, of that which is causing harm to ourselves or others, when we see it clearly again and again, when we become familiar with the way it operates in us. So this attitude is really helpful in our meditation practice and in our lives, in the bigger context of our Dharma practice. The way we act, the way we interact, the way we meditate, all of these. So if we use meditation as an example, if anything that arises in my meditation, if I perceive it as my essence, as who I am, I'll inevitably end up putting myself down, blaming myself, beating myself up, or raising myself up, thinking I should be giving this talk, not this poor fool who's sitting there trying her best, whatever it is. So we kind of then get caught up in this praise and blame mechanism with ourselves. And that actually becomes the happening of our practice. Because whatever arises is who I am as a meditator. It's my essence. But we have another possibility for that not to define who we are, but to see it as an arising. And when we see it as an arising, that gives us possibility and choice of how to respond, of what to let go of. When we're caught up in this praise and blame, good and bad, I'm this or that, we're causing a lot of suffering. Unintentionally, important to remember. We're doing this because that's our habit. But we're causing a lot of suffering, primarily to ourselves, but also to others. Because we're carrying this weight that isn't needed. And we're missing the opportunity to see the flow of life, to see the change of life, to see the unfolding of life, and to join that, to join that flow. We're missing the opportunity to learn, to work with, to play with the things that make up our life, that make up our experience. So this is really key. If you had to remember one thing from this talk, I would really want you to remember this line. Events and actions, not essence. The things that arise, the things that we do, the things that we say, the things that we think, they're events. They're happenings, as one of our teachers used to say. They're happenings. He used to say to us, let the happening happen. Let the happening happen. It's not who you are. It's a happening happening. It's not who we are. It's not our essence. And to include in this, the fact that naturally, as we play, as we learn, as we experiment, we make mistakes. So we'll see ourselves holding on to something or identifying. And there'll be sometimes very little we can do except bear witness with compassion and kindness to that suffering that's happening there within us or in another also. So we'll make mistakes, but mistakes are part of the learning process. And again, we have the kids here to really remind us of that. They make mistakes, and usually they make them quite freely. And they learn, and they move on. You know, for the really small ones, it can be the learning to move around that they're learning, or to speak. If they were afraid to do that, they would never learn. If we had been afraid when we were babies to say something the wrong way or to fall flat on our faces, we would have never learned how to speak, how to walk. So mistakes are a really crucial part of the process, and it's really worth remembering. So as we practice in this way of play, experimentation, actions and events, not essence, our patience and our honesty grow, our mindfulness, our presence, our wisdom, grow. And this takes a lot from us. You know, this path takes our commitment, it takes our determination. It requires the effort to come back again and again. You know, to go to the meditation hall when there's a lake. To come back to the breath when there's a really cool fantasy happening in the mind. It takes that kind of effort to come back. It requires the effort to investigate our actions, our speech, our thoughts, and their results. That all takes energy. But it offers possibilities of well-being, of happiness, that are boundless, unlimited, and unconditioned. And it offers us the possibility to live in tune with our deepest aspirations, with our deepest sense of what we can be, of what we are. And how we want that to manifest internally and externally. So over the days here, just inviting ourselves to really sink into the practice with that flavor of experimentation, of play, of creativity, which takes dedication and commitment and effort and takes openness and receptivity and relaxation, and to see what comes, to see what unfolds for us. So let's have a few quiet moments together to bring this to a close. So we've got a little bit of time. And so finding a reasonably comfortable posture. And we'll just spend a few minutes here together. Just allowing what's been heard, what's been listened to settle. To be. So may our practice together over these days continue to be a nourishment for us on our path. May we continue to explore and investigate this wonder of a human life together. And may our practice be for the welfare and the benefit of all beings everywhere. So thank you for your listening and your presence. We have about 5 minutes until dinner. We'll keep this space silent so people can carry on sitting and being in silence if they wish up until dinner. And then obviously the rest of the space is not in silence. So thank you.